edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. The Irish have had a major impact on the development of the national pastime since the early days of the game. As the potato famine made life in their native country more difficult, many came to America in the mid-1800s, determined to integrate into their new society as quickly as possible. One of the ways to do this was to adopt the new national game, baseball. Like many immigrant groups, the Irish weren't always welcome, but they persevered, and many became among the heroes of the sport, including Connie Mack, born Cornelius McGillicuddy, and John McGraw, as well as scores of other players, managers, and executives like King Kelly, Charles Comiskey, Pud Galvin, Iron Man Joe McGinnity, Mickey Cochran, and all the way through contemporary players like Whitey Ford, Al Kaline, Dave McNally, and Dale Murphy, to name just a few. Charlie Rosen has collected all of these players and contributions in his new book, The Emerald Diamond, How the Irish Transformed America's Greatest Pastime. I thought it would be an appropriate topic with St. Patrick's Day just around the corner, so I spoke with Rosen recently about the many discoveries he made on his journalistic journey.
Charlie Rosen, welcome to the bookshelf.
Well, Ron, thank you for putting me on the shelf.
So,
I've been on the shelf for quite a while, actually.
What's a nice Jewish boy like you doing writing a book about the Irish?
Well, I wanted to do a book about the Fiji Islanders and the National Hockey League, but they didn't think that would go. And I also tried to do a book about, I did a proposal about Jewish basketball players, the history of Jewish basketball players in the pros, and they didn't go for that either. So the publishing company, HarperCollins, suggested the Irish. And my wife is half Irish, so that's rationale enough.
And it's kind of surprising because of the role, especially early on, of Jews in basketball, that that's not something that would be a little more popular.
Well, they dominated the sport, really, for the first 50, 60 years. And actually, there is a publishing company that is interested, and we're started preliminary talks.
Oh, good. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Now, last year you published Bullpen Diaries, which followed the Yankees' relief corps in 2010. That's a striking difference in topic from a historical perspective. So I should mention the name of your new book is The Emerald Diamond, How the Irish Transformed America's Greatest Game. So could you talk a little bit about the differences in your approach for something that was much more contemporary with something that started in the 19th century?
Well, you know, the two aspects to it. Number one, I pitched in college. I wasn't very good, but I could throw hard, and I've been a Yankee fan all my life. Coming from the Bronx, I used to be able to walk to Yankee Stadium and go to 40 games or so a year. I had a tryout with the Yankees in 1963, which went bust after I almost killed somebody with a very wild fastball. I went to my first Yankee game in 1947, so that's kind of ingrained in me, and I felt a natural affinity for the Yankees. I was always interested in the bullpens and the way relief pitching has changed the structure of a relief staff these days with so many specialists. Seventh inning specialists, eighth inning specialists, long relief guys, you know, the whole thing. So doing that book was an extension of something I was always interested in. As far as going back and doing the book about the Irish in baseball, I also have an interest in history and the history of sports, which really began with the history of basketball. And and it seemed like a good marriage, you know, the history, my interest in history, plus my interest in baseball. Plus, they made me, the publishing company made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
Now, most of the book, or a good deal of the book, seems to take place prior to the 1920s. When did a player's nationality or ethnicity stop becoming an issue?
Has it stopped?
Well, if you look
at
Lynn, obviously not. But a lot of players nowadays, I think the readers would be surprised that some of the players that you highlight in the book are Irish. Like, you can't, early on, you can tell by the names Kelly, Mac, McGillicuddy, McGraw. But, you know, Richie Ashburn, Al Kaline, you know, I wouldn't have thought they were Irish. So
well, even Jim Thorpe was a quarter Irish.
Okay.
But you know what has happened? I did interview several contemporary players, coaches for the book, and what has happened has been a lot of intermarriage. So you rarely find, at least the people that I spoke to, people who are 100% Irish, and the young guys, the young athletes, baseball players, the ones I spoke to. They've lost that real, most of them have lost that really intense dedication and interest in their Irish heritage, and they've become Americans. I mean, Nolan Ryan said he considers himself more of a Texan than an Irishman. So it's the melting pot. It's, you know, the whole thing's changed. But that said, 12% of the American population is Irish or has Irish roots, and 18% of major leaguers as of last season were Irish. So there's still, and 20% of the managers who were employed last season were also Irish. So it's still a factor.
Now, how'd you go about doing the research for a book like this?
I read a lot of other books, and I spoke to a lot of people. I went down to Shea Stadium a couple of times to try and find Irish ball players. I was careful to go down. You know, I looked through the rosters of everybody down there. But it was a lot of research. There were a lot of books written before me, a good biography of Ed De La Hente, a good biography of King Kelly, a biography of Connie Mack, but the whole thing had not been put together in a chronological order. So I took bits and pieces from a lot of different sources and some original stuff, historical stuff about the Irish famine. It was research, a lot of research, which, you know, I have a master's in medieval English, so I'm well accustomed to research, although it's a lot easier with computers than spending hours in a dusty old library like it used to be.
Now, I just want to focus on one player in particular who wasn't Irish, but when you write about how the way the Irish were treated early on, Camp Anson seems to be a real equal opportunity hater. He didn't like the Irish. He didn't like the blacks. I don't imagine there were too many Jews playing in those days, but I'm sure he wouldn't have liked them either.
Well, there was a specific prejudice against the Irish in the when he first started playing, because the game was kind of in the late 19th century, maybe the last third of the 19th century, it was kind of an aristocratic game that was played by gentlemen. And the Irish added a kind of a rowdyism and a fierce competitive nature to it that upset a lot of people. So there was a prejudice against the Irish. There were a lot of They used to advertise for ball players, and they would include the initials N-I-N-A, which meant no Irishman need apply. And that was kind of a semi-official thing, much like the barring of black Americans later on. And some people never really got over that, including Cap Anson, who was a great player, great manager, he's in the Hall of Fame. And he felt that several Irish players on several teams were conspiring against him to get rid of him. And he was correct. It was part of the culture. The latest immigrant group, and there was a lot of Irish folks came over after the potato famine started in 1845. There's a huge immigration. I mean, a lot of them were killed, starved to death, but there's a huge immigration. And any time that happens, they're taking people's jobs, and they're forced to live in ghettos, and they usually low economic situations, which makes people turn up their noses. And it happens to every immigrant group. But baseball, some of the old-timers like Cap Anson thought that they were sullying the game because the Irish, and it must be said, really played a violent brand of baseball and were argumentative. There was one umpire in those days, and they did all kinds of tricks, hit balls in the outfield, a ball would go over the head, and they had no lights, of course. Games began at 3 o'clock, so it was kind of dark in the late innings. Make believe they were making a great catch of the ball that was in the grass and hold on to guys' belts and cut bases, go from second base almost directly to home plate while the lone umpire was following the ball. So there was a lot of ill will that occurred amongst the old timers because of that. They felt that they were cheapening the game and just, as I said, bringing a kind of rowdyism, which is true to a certain degree. But the Irish also, at that time, they forced the rules to change by finding loopholes in all the rules and taking full advantage of them. So the Irish players did help modernize the game. And as things cooled down, as it became more and more accepted that they were going to be great Irish players, and old fogies like Anson were out of the game, things calmed down a little bit, and they were just ball players.
And to what do you attribute the impact, the influence of some of the great Irishmen as managers, like Connie Mack and John McGraw?
They knew the game. They knew, players with great talent, great ability, and this goes for most sports, they very rarely make good coaches or managers because it's too easy for them. They could just, in basketball, they just out-quick, out-jump, out-talent guys. In baseball, you throw 95 miles an hour or just be a natural hitter. But guys with marginal talents, like Connie Mack, he was a good receiver. He was never a very good hitter. McGraw wasn't a very good hitter to begin with, but he had to learn to bunt. He was a great bunter. He had to learn to hit to the opposite field. And he learned every detail. He could break the game down so that guys like that became great teachers because they really understood the fundamentals of the game, and they demanded that their players play with the same kind of passion that they played with when they were active. So I think that's one reason. And guys are just there from the beginning, and they just longevity is a good thing. It's for any kind of work. They just learn their jobs very well.
I'm just curious. Do you think the fact that neither of them were good players, did that make them more or less sympathetic to players that they managed who were on their talent level?
It depends. depends. It goes on an individual basis. I mean, take Joe McCarthy, who was a great manager, who won, you know, how many World Series with the Yankees. He was not a very good player. He never played in the major leagues. And he was very intolerant of inferior play. He had no sympathy for players who couldn't really make the grade, who failed in situations, who were careless. Whereas Connie Mack was a little more forgiving. Casey Stengel was half Irish. And he was an okay player. He had his moments, you know, home runs in, what was it, the 21 World Series, two game-winning home runs. But he had a lighter attitude, so he was obviously, if he managed the Mets at the beginning of their history, he had to be tolerant of inferior players.
Now, many of your previous books, both fiction and nonfiction, have been about basketball. So is there much of a difference in writing about the two sports? Is baseball enhanced at all by the fact that it's roomier? There's more room to roam than in basketball, which is much more contained. Does that have anything to do with the excellent writing about baseball and on a smaller level, basketball?
Well, somebody says that the smaller the ball, the better the writing. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly why that happens. I think the history of baseball is more present in the consciousness of sports America, because in any given baseball game there's so much dead time. I mean, if you put a stopwatch on a baseball game, there would be perhaps 10 or 15 minutes of real, actual live action. Whereas in basketball game, it's 48 minutes of live action, and there's not enough time for commentators to talk about the history of basketball while the game is going on. But baseball, that's part of the whole routine. Oh, remember this guy, this anecdote, you know, this happened to me, this happened to you. So there's a familiarity with baseball that sets it apart. And it is the national pastime. It's not the most popular game anymore, at least not since the point spread was invented. But it's still, you know, dads playing catch with their children and that kind of thing. It's more a part of our culture, I think.
Now, this book, The Emerald Diamond, and the previous book, The Yankee about the Yankee Bullpen, are recent additions to your oeuvre. Do you find it easier to write about baseball than basketball?
Well, I know basketball better, and I am personally more familiar with the history of basketball. There are more available statistics in baseball, which make it somewhat easier, although I mistrust the statistics in both baseball and basketball, and I can't stand that Moneyball nonsense. You know, it's no numbers can predict what's going to happen in any specific at-bat. It really doesn't work. It's, you know, on base percentage, points per game, it's not how many or how high or whatever, it's when you do what you do. You know, there are baseball players, I can remember one, Manny Mota, hit like 350-something. He never got hit in the clutch. You know, and you see guys like Scott Brosius, who, what did he hit, 250, 260? And he was a great clutch hitter. You can't quantify the human spirit. And I think that's what all this slavish devotion to numbers does. But our whole culture is like that. Who's number one? You know, what's your mortgage rate? What's how many miles per gallon do you get? Who's number one in the polls? What percentage of the votes? Numbers, 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 numbers. But numbers are like a finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon. It's just a finger pointing at the moon.
So in the Emerald Diamond, for all the research you've done, do you have a favorite Irish play or a story?
I kind of like the story that opens it up, a game in 1894 between the Pittsburgh Pirates and a team from Kansas City, which was a pro team but not in the National League. And a lot of teams used to play a lot of exhibition games in those days just for money. They'd play 30, 40 exhibition games during the season. And illustrative of how the Irish forced the rules to change is the a runner on second base, two out, score is tied in the bottom of the ninth inning, batter gets a base hit, the runner comes tearing around third, the coach at third base, and coaches were either the manager or a player, and there was only one coach. If there was a runner on first, he would coach first base. If there's a runner on second or on third, he move over and coach third base. And the outfielder picks up the ball and makes a strong throw to home plate, and it's obvious that the ball is going to beat the runner, and he's going to be out. So the coach runs ahead of the runner, Make sure not to step in fair territory, which is the only prohibition of what he did. Smashed into the catcher. The ball went one way. The catcher went flying. The run scored. Game over.
Wow.
And so they put in the coach's box rule. There are a lot of stories like that. Jim Kelly was too drunk. Mike Kelly was too drunk to play one game, and he's sitting on the bench. He was a catcher, and the benches were just slat benches, 15, 20 feet from the foul lines, no roof or anything like that. And it's a key point of the game, and the other team is up, and a guy hits a foul pop-up that the catcher can't reach. So Kelly jumps up, and he says, "Substitution, Kelly now catching for Boston," runs over and catches the fly, the pop fly, and to win the game.
Wow. We've been talking with Charlie Rosen, author of The Emerald Diamond, How the Irish Transformed America's Greatest Game. You're going to be appearing at Foley's on the 21st, Foley's New York Pub and Restaurant in Manhattan. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a great place. I spent a day down there when they had their induction ceremony, because they are the official, certified by the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame. It's a great place. They have mementos all over the place, and thousands of autographed balls and bats and little statuettes. They have a little one that caught my eye was St. Patrick leaning on a baseball bat instead of a staff. Just a million things like that. It's a great place. They're really wonderful people. I had a wonderful time down there. Good food. Just about everybody who works there speaks with a lilt, an Irish lilt. So the last chapter in the book is my visit down there. They're just good-spirited people. There's, every ethnic group has, if you can make generalities, which you shouldn't, there are good people, there are bad people, but there's a certain generosity of spirit in the Irish people that I connected with in researching the book that was warming to me, very encouraging, that I enjoyed a lot.
And if you want to find out more about the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame, visit irishbaseballhall.com. Again, that's going to be Wednesday, March 21st at 6 o'clock. Charlie Rosen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was the bookshelf conversation with Charlie Rosen. A review of the book will be up on the website later in the week, as well as on bookreporter.com. Charlie Rosen will be the featured speaker at a program at Foley's New York Pub and Restaurant on Wednesday, March 21, beginning at 6 o'clock. Foley's is the home to the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame. For more information, visit irishbaseballhall.com and foliesny.com. And that'll do it for another podcast edition of The Bookshelf. Remember to visit the website for daily updates. Recent entries include information about Buddy Harrelson and R.A. Dickey making author appearances in the New York area, as well as what the postman has brought me recently. Your comments are always appreciated, so please drop me a line to ron@ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com. So long, everybody.